Hello, and welcome back to Season 10 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm that manages more than $110 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. This week, we have a special episode. We're going to speak with two of HPS's governing partners in a panel about current credit market trends. Take a listen. Joining me today is Pranima Puri, who leads our public credit strategies, and Mike Patterson, who leads our senior private credit strategies. Thank you both for joining us. I'd like to start with the relationship between private and public credit. Since 2008, private credit has grown from quite a small asset class to a roughly comparable size to the broadly syndicated market. Both have grown materially, but private credit has clearly taken market share. Mike, maybe we'll start with you. What's been the interplay between liquid and private credit markets in recent years, and how do you see that evolving going forward?
I think it has evolved a lot, and I think the driver for the evolution over the course of the past 4 or 5 years has been the capacity of the private markets to provide a complete solution in larger and larger situations. There's always been an ebb and a flow, and I think the public markets react more dramatically to changes maybe in macroeconomic prognostications. But if we look over a several quarter period, there's a general sense of equilibrium between the public and the private. There are times when public markets are more aggressive. I think the private markets tend to be open in times of stress, where the public markets tend to be functionally closed in times of stress, but that quickly fixes itself once those periods of dislocation resolve. But I do think the biggest change is the equilibrium used to just be at the lower end from a scale perspective of the public markets. And I think now that equilibrium exists, not just at the extreme lower end of what the public market will finance, but maybe in the middle, you know, from a non-investment grade perspective, the middle as measured by scale, just because it's a round number. You know, the $1 billion transaction, if we looked at it 5 years ago, I don't think private credit was a credible competitor to the public markets. And now it's a credible competitor. And so an equilibrium exists. And, you know, there are quarters when that's 3 or 4% of stuff being done in the private markets and the rest of it done in the public markets. And there are quarters where it's 25% of stuff being done in the private markets relative to the public markets. But it's not zero for the $1 billion potential loan. And there was a period of time when it was.
All right. So Pranima, when you think about it from a borrower's perspective in terms of accessing either liquid or the private credit solutions, what are factors that would make you push in one direction versus the other?
I think first, Mike touched on this, the openness of the capital markets and whether they can access the broadly syndicated loan market is important to borrowers, mostly because oftentimes the spreads are tighter than private credit. And even in the world that we're living in today, they continue to be tighter. And those spreads range from, call it 150 to 200 basis points. So query one is, are the capital markets open and can you issue? I think with regard to what we've seen from borrowers, and even in today's market, there's a variety of things that are important. So one is a rating is super important. You know, can a borrower access the liquid market? 60%+ of that buyer base are CLO buyers. That is a ratings dependent market. Many are insurance companies, also a ratings dependent market. And I would actually say, that's relevant for the moment in time you're in as well, as opposed to looking at a credit over a cycle, because that rating may change. Two is speed of execution. In a year like 2023, private credit refinanced 34 deals, $27 billion of par value. So Mike had alluded to sort of the push and pull here. This year, the liquid markets have refinanced 28 deals and $9 billion of par market value. So, you know, you see it sort of going back and forth, and it turns out those numbers are roughly aligned in terms of the par value if you were to annualize it. So 23 and 22, when the markets are a little bit frozen, private credit can offer a solution much more quickly in some instances. There may be flexibility that a borrower might need, some pick toggle features, portability features are important, delay draw for acquisitions to build a business over time. Oftentimes, those things are things that private credit can provide that liquid credit sometimes can't.
Yeah, I always think of it as the public markets have a very narrow, well-defined box. And if you fit inside that box, it is the cheapest and most efficient way to finance your business. But if you need something outside that box, the public markets, most of the buyers being CLO buyers, as Pranima said, they don't have the capacity to provide that flexibility. So the private credit world can work around, you know, the company's needs in a way that the public market maybe can't. But if you fit within the narrow box that fits the public markets, it's the cheapest way to finance your company.
Let's talk about documentation. So docs have weakened in the liquid credit markets for many years, leading to a rise in liability management exercises, defaults. But in the last 2 years, you saw public lenders gain a bit of the upper hand, documents tighten back a bit. Private credit historically benefited from tighter docs, but with so much capital raised, some private lenders were willing to forego strong creditor protections. With the markets on the liquid side open, at least for high quality issuers, and so much dry powder in private credit, will the pendulum swing back towards looser documentation?
I think probably yes. So a couple things. The first is that this year, the new issues have been predominantly, I think the number is 67% refinancings. So it hasn't been sort of core new issue news. The second is a lot of it has been much higher quality issuers. So the minute you get into the higher quality issuers, you're going to actually see looser documents. In the same way, if you take the extreme investment grade documents, have the loosest documents in the bond market. So you've definitely seen that. What will be interesting to see is when the market opens up for the lower quality issuers, whether or not the buyer base will be able to continue to push for tighter protections or not. But really what we've seen this year is much more higher quality issuance.
And I completely agree with the likely trend. We have to look at supply and demand. And in this case, it's the supply of potential lending opportunities and the demand for those, meaning how much capital has been raised, both on the private side and the publicly traded side. You know, M&A volumes still are a fraction of what they were going back to 2021. I think a lot of people expected a really robust rebound in the first half of 2024, and that hasn't materialized. Is it up year on year? Yes. But has it returned to the previous equilibrium levels? The answer is no. And so refinancing has been a huge theme. New M&A lending has been less active than people anticipated. One of the ways that capital can make itself more attractive is to give people more flexibility on the document. So I agree with you. I think we will see that. But I also think that people have focused on things that matter. These documents are 350 pages long. There are a borderline infinite number of things you can argue about and negotiate, but I think there are a finite number of things that actually matter when a business doesn't go according to plan. And I do think that people's spines have been stiffened over the last 2 years about things that matter. The two, and like I said, there are many, but the two that matter most is the ability to add incremental debt even when a business is underperforming, and the ability to move the pieces around the chessboard, specifically to move collateral away from the original secured loan that was secured by that collateral. And one is, if we think of a recovery after a default as a numerator, meaning the assets you recover on, and in a denominator, the amount of debt that's recovering on those assets, those move both those numbers. And in the really extreme circumstances, there are more people recovering on less collateral, and that really affects recoveries. So I think holding the line on some of those critical issues, I do think people's spines have been stiffened over the last 2 years. But I also think the overall trend of docs is not getting progressively tighter through 2024. I actually think it's getting more permissive.
You guys, as portfolio managers, think about risk in the portfolio all day long. Can you talk about some of the macro risks, things you pay attention to and worry about, both for the overall market and for individual portfolios?
So I think the first is everyone's been all eyes on inflation. That's been the theme really since the end of 2020. In the world of the liquid markets, one of the big things we're always watching is the rate environment and what that means in terms of allocations between loans and high yield, between investment grade, CLO debt, et cetera. You know, we came into the year, the market was pricing 6 or 7 cuts. The market has now taken that down to 2 cuts because we've continued to have some reads where inflation moderating is tempering. And we need some more indicators to see where that might land. And I think as a result of that, you've heard the rhetoric of higher for longer. We do think that's true. We think that you may see some cuts that may be 1 cut. It might be 2 cuts, but it's unlikely to be 3 plus. All of that's driven by inflation. And when we think about that, we're really pretty focused on what that means for sort of medium-term bonds and high-yield bonds. And our view is that it's very difficult to get 10-year treasuries much below 4% for a variety of reasons. One is that the Fed has said we want real rates north of 2%. Two is that you have less buyers, so the technical dynamic's not your friend. And I would say three is there's sort of one risk that's creeping, and it seems to be people aren't focused on it as much as maybe they should be, which is the federal deficit. And there's a lot of mega trends that are spend-oriented and inflation-oriented, deglobalization, defense spending, transition to green economy, et cetera. And so we're pretty focused on that in terms of the broader macro risks, I would say, in the market.
And I think when we try to risk spot at a granular level in the private credit portfolio, there are two things that we're wary about. I think if you had told me in 2022 that we would be 2 years into an inflationary environment with rates north of 5% and we had not seen significant profit margin degradation of the portfolio, I would have said that was highly improbable. That's what's happened. I think the underlying portfolio companies that we observe, and I think in our conversations with other people in the private credit space, we've all been pleasantly surprised by how nimbly management teams have navigated this environment. They've flexed their cost structures, but in particular, they've passed through inflationary supply prices on their top line. And that's actually, in some cases, expanded certainly dollar profits and held profit margins. So I think an exhaustion of that ability to raise prices, which maybe is another way of saying the inflationary environment starts to reach an asymptote, the ability to pass them through, and we do see profit margins starting to decline. I think that is underpriced in the market and underappreciated. And I don't think it stretches the imagination in a world of higher rates to see that happening, the inability to ultimately pass through higher prices starting to hit the corporate bottom line. And then the second, and maybe this is very specific to the world of private equity lending, is one of the dominant strategies over the course of the past decade in a world of really low rates and ample liquidity in the credit markets has been the private equity roll-up, the ability to pay pretty handsomely for a platform and then build equity value over time with debt-funded acquisitions. And I think that strategy works in most macro environments, if you have decent organic growth in the underlying platform, if the underlying business really exhibits some positive, and they don't have to be wildly positive characteristics, but it is a GDP or GDP plus organic grower. But that strategy works in the macro environment of the last decade, even with no organic growth. You can manufacture organic growth with really cheap debt-funded acquisitions with low base rates and low spreads. And those have been successful for a decade. I think some of those platforms, which are quite large and have huge debt facilities supporting them, they woke up in 2022 and their cost of financing went up 500 basis points over the course of three quarters. And we look at them and say, this company, which has been successful for a long period of time, we don't think they return the cost of capital. And I don't think that's been processed in the debt community sufficiently.
So let's talk about the maturity wall. So over the last 15 years, anytime there's been any market volatility or stress, people talk about the maturity wall and raise the hue and cry that it's going to be a problem, and it's never once really mattered. But for the first time since 2007, we have high interest rates. And for many borrowers, you just have a math problem. You've got a quantum of debt where suddenly, per your point, my cash interest expense just gets too high for existing debt levels. How will refinancings in the coming couple of years be managed given the new breadth of options we have in front of new borrowers?
So I do think it's going to require some creativity. I think the math problem in terms of interest coverage is real. In some of these situations, the answer is you need to inject more equity and pay down the debt stack, and then you have a refinanceable quantum of debt. That the new equity can also be new junior debt. I mean, I think there's a very real need and a very interesting application of subordinated private credit. And it's in the capital structure of something that is currently overlevered, taking a subordinated position, being able to mix cash pay with payment in kind so that the company can deal with its overall debt load, and then maybe have a senior piece that is now refinanceable in the public markets at a reasonable or even attractive spread to the company. I think that is something we're going to see more and more of. So the ability of private credit to play a creative role or refinance the entire cap stack and blend those two. So I think that's one option. When I look at the maturity wall, if I were a CFO, for some reason, it seems like the world has decided that a maturity wall should be measured over the course of the next 3 years of how much matures. And I just don't think that captures any sort of time pressure. I think the real maturity wall is the next 12 months. Over the next 12 months, when there's an excessive amount of debt due, then there's a pig in the python problem of trying to solve all those at the same time when the market might not be receptive. We saw that in 2023. I think before the public markets became more receptive to low single B issuers, there was a real problem. But I think the market that we're in today, it's going to be a mix of a public and private solution in order to deal with the refinancings. But it is not a wall. Like, it's not. I think there was a period of time when we thought there was, but the market tends to resolve this in a really rational way.
I agree with Mike on the maturity wall. I think it's been sort of 5% matures every year or something like that in the history of time, as far as we can remember. And maybe it's 7 or 8% now. But what I do think you're going to see, which I think is interesting in the liquid markets more so, is shortening of duration. I think the way that if you're a CFO and you're looking at capital structures and you say, gosh, whether I'm an investment grade company or even a high yield company, what can I do to allow myself to have the optionality to refinance into a lower rate environment in the future? The shorter duration is better. And you're actually seeing that. So the investment grade index has shortened a lot from roughly 8.8 years to 6.7 years. And the high yield index has shortened. If you look at the high yield index, it's shortened from 6 years to under 5 years. So it's about 4.8 years. So I do think you're going to continue to see lower issuance in long duration, because if you're running a business, you kind of want the option to refinance lower when rates come in.
And that's because the lower duration comes with shorter call protection. So you're back in the window of being able to do it costlessly.
So there's A, the call protection, which your point's exactly right. And then the second point is just the ability to say, hey, I'm going to do a five. We saw this, for example, when spreads were wide in COVID, we saw a bunch of five-year bonds really good crossover type credits, as opposed to 10 and 15-year bonds that you might have seen historically.
Because just from the CFO's perspective, it's like, okay, I think this spread is artificially high.
Exactly.
And I'll deal with it for a short amount of time, but not a long amount of time. That makes sense.
So let's talk about default rates. So if you go back to the global financial crisis, default rates spiked out in the leveraged loan environment at around a 14% rate. For the last 15 years, it's been between, you know, sort of 2.5% and 3%, with moments of episodic stress where energy and power companies filed, where all the retailers restructured, but generally fairly benign. Given the amount of macroeconomic risks, given the rate environment, let's start with you, Pranima. What do you see in the public markets for expectations for default rates in the near term?
So I think people have shifted their expectations a lot. And we don't see a massive, massive tick up in default rates going forward. We're seeing some degree of tick up, but a lot of it is going to be dependent on what Mike alluded to earlier in this conversation, which is, can people continue to pass through price and can people continue to maintain their margins? Because for the most part, companies have hung in there. You've seen an uptick in defaults. You've seen an uptick in liability management. We've talked about that already. But in terms of actual default rates, there's not that many maturities in the next 12 months. That's first of all, most important. The other thing I will say with regard to default rates for those companies that have a longer maturity is you are seeing more of the liability management, which we talked about, and that's allowing companies to sort of kick the can for a little while and keep playing through in ways that may not be so lender friendly. And that has actually prevented a lot of defaults that we would have seen at a different moment in time in the markets.
And I think also changes the path. I think we need to evolve the conversation around defaults to one around losses, because I think we have changed the nature of underlying debt. It's become much more complex. And what used to be a loan, now there are six different types of that same loan, and they have different risk characteristics. And that'll be expressed in different losses when something defaults. So it used to be, I think, a statistically defensible pattern to just talk about defaults and assume that recoveries were about 70 cents on the dollar. That was true over a long period of time. And there were periods where it was lower and maybe it was 50 or 60, and periods where it was higher and maybe it was in the 80s. But that 65 cent, 70 cent recovery for first lien senior secured loans, there was a lot of strong data saying that as a measure of central tendency, it was defensible. I think we might have broken through that as a defensible average. And the statistics will have to prove whether this point is right or wrong. But talking about risks, Colbert, in the credit markets in general, I worry that our mindset has not shifted into one where we're talking about losses and seeing the severity of losses for each default significantly higher than we have in historical periods. That a weakening in documentation after a decade of a reasonably low default rate means that that documentation, when it's leaned upon to defend a credit, is a lot less effective. And so we see recoveries 30 cents, 40 cents, not 70 cents, so that the same default rate is twice as bad when we look at losses. I think that's one of the things that we are concerned about from a risk perspective.
And I'd say, just to add to what Mike's saying here, on the liquid side, you're actually seeing companies where in those liability management transactions and those sort of left behind lenders, as I like to say, that paper might be trading sub 50 cents and not defaulted. And when we started doing this a long time ago, you didn't see that.
Right. That was almost mathematically impossible historically, because anything trading at 50, there would have been a covenant that was about to be breached, in which case you could drive it to trade north of 8, should have been worth more than 50. So I agree. That's a unique phenomenon in the history of the credit market. So the trading prices are starting to reflect it. I mean, the nice part about the public markets versus the private markets is, let's say there's a really good company where you think the probability of default is very low relative to the average probability of default. You can own that. Things in the industry could change. You could conclude you were wrong, and you can sell it. So you don't have to necessarily rely on the document for recoveries. You can actually price a weak document relative to a really strong business and decide that it's still a good investment. Whereas on the private side, we will live with those mistakes, and we will be part of the workout, because we can't really rely on liquidity as an element of risk mitigation in any efficient way. So I do think you might see a separation of the markets even more from what we have to do on the private side from a documentation perspective, and what you can do on the public side, because you can use liquidity as a way to actually manage that risk.
Thank you, Pranima and Mike, for all your insights, and thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen.
This material was presented by HPS Investment Partners, LLC, for information purposes only. Nothing contained herein constitutes investment, legal, tax, or other advice, nor is it to be relied on in making an investment or other decision. HPS makes no representation or warranty, express or implied, with respect to the information contained herein, including, without limitation, information obtained from third parties, and expressly disclaims any and all liability based on or relating to the information contained in, or errors or omissions, negligent or otherwise, from these materials, or based on or relating to the recipient's use or the use by any of its affiliates or representatives of these materials. This material may contain forward-looking statements. These are based upon a number of assumptions concerning future conditions that ultimately may prove to be inaccurate. Such forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties and may be affected by various factors that may cause actual results to differ materially from those in the forward-looking statements. Any forward-looking statements speak only as of the date they are made, and HPS assumes no duty to and does not undertake to update forward-looking statements or any other information contained herein.